Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Tuesday. It's November 21. It's a wonderful day, and it's starting off well on the East Coast, here in Yonkers and in Westchester County. And I'm very excited. I wasn't sure if we were going to hear from Jeffrey Swartz and Brendan Beery, both from Cooley Law School. They're professors there at the Tampa Bay campus. They're not going to be on today. I misread my emails, so my apology for that. So it'll just be you and I, and I wanted to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving before I continue. So I guess the thing to recognize is that a lot of things are happening, and let's start off with what's happening on the local scene. Yonkers Mayor Mike Spano is going to deliver over 400 Thanksgiving dinners to needy families in Yonkers. It seems that the mayor will deliver over 400 Thanksgiving dinners to needy families in Yonkers. It's going to take place today at 12 noon at the Yonkers Police Athletic League, located at 127 North Broadway. The dinners are supplied by private donations from the Yonkers Police Athletic League, PAL, the Yonkers Contracting Company, ShopRite, Valley Oil Company, Fidelis, and PCNY. Each donation will consist of turkey and all its fixings. The deserving families were pre-selected by local community-based organizations. And since coming into office in 2012, Mayor Spano has organized a donation of Thanksgiving dinners in Yonkers families every year. So, again, the location is the Yonkers Police Athletic League Gymnasium at 127 North Broadway in Yonkers, New York. It's going to begin at 12 noon today, and it's just, it's wonderful. It really is wonderful. the magnanimity of the city and, of course, the mayor through his leadership, it's all there. And it's truly wonderful. And it's at a time where not everyone has the capacity to enjoy the wonders of Thanksgiving. And hopefully the meal will engage more people to be thankful as well. So that's what's going on there. Let's look at some other things and hopefully you'll find interesting. Bear with me a moment. Where is it here? I wanted to get to some other things locally. That's where we're going to be. And then I wanted to go on to the international stage. Bear with me a moment. This is the latest information from the Israel-Hamas war. Netanyahu is hinting at progress on hostages. Well, it seems that Israel's prime minister suggested there may be, quote, good news soon, end quote, on a hostage release deal, which the United States said could be close. The Hamas militant group is negotiating via Qatari mediators on a temporary truce. And so Israeli prime minister today said, as he addressed the Qatar-mediated negotiations, following an array of comments from Palestinians, Qataris, and U.S. officials involved in the talks, raising hopes that the accord might be close. So we are making progress, Netanyahu told Israeli reservists, according to a statement published by his office. Quote, I don't think it's worth saying too much, not even at this moment, but I hope there will be good news soon, end quote. Earlier comments from other parties to the negotiations have been similarly optimistic, only without anybody claiming that a deal was done. Netanyahu's office also said that, quote, in light of developments in the matter of the release of our hostages, end quote, the prime minister would convene his war cabinet at 6 p.m. And that's about 4 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time, his broader security cabinet an hour later, and his entire cabinet an hour after that. In Qatar, which is mediating the talks, foreign ministry spokesman Maed al-Ansari told reporters on Tuesday that, quote, we are at the closest point we ever had been in reaching an agreement, quote, adding that, quote, we're very optimistic and very hopeful, end quote. The United Kingdom has called for the release of a ship hijacked by Houthis. Well, the United Kingdom today condemned the hijacking of the Galaxy Leader, a commercial ship by Houthis in the Red Sea, calling for the immediate release of the vessel and its crew. The United Kingdom condemns the unlawful seizure of the MV Galaxy Leader by the Houthis at the Red Sea, and we call for the immediate and unconditional release of the ship and its crew, a spokesperson for the Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office said today. This follows a similar appeal late on Monday from the United States State Department that referred to the seizure as, quote, a flagrant violation of international law, end quote. The ship's owner, Galaxy Maritime Limited, also issued a statement about its vessel on Monday, saying it was in the region of the port of Hodeidah in Yemen. It said that the ship was, quote, illegally boarded by military personnel by a helicopter, end quote, on Monday, November 19th. Yemen's Iran-backed Houthis has released video footage online, seemingly confirming this, quote, all communications were subsequently lost with the vessel, end quote, the Isle of Man registered company said, quote, the company, as a shipping concern, will not be commenting further on the political or geopolitical situation, end quote. Israel had referred to the ship's hijacking as, quote, an Iranian act of terrorism, end quote, given the Houthis' ties to Iran. The Houthis, meanwhile, had described the British-owned Japanese-operated vessel with a multinational crew as an Israeli ship. Lebanese media has reported that two journalists were killed near the Israeli border. Lebanon's state news agency has said that two journalists working for a Lebanese TV channel and a third person were killed by a rocket strike near the border with Israel. The agency said the incident took place near the town of Te'ir Halfa, a short distance from the Israeli border. Al-Mayadeen TV, the outlet which employed the reporters, alleged that Israel had carried out the attack and deliberately targeted the journalists. The state-run national news agency described the incident as, quote, an enemy bombing, end quote. Israel's military did not immediately comment. Well, the cross-border violence between Israel and the Lebanese-Iran-backed Hezbollah group has taken place sporadically since Hamas's October 7 attacks and Israel's retaliation, but to date only on a comparatively small scale of the repeated calls not to allow the conflict to spread beyond Gaza. Nevertheless, the fighting has been the worst at the border since Israel and Hezbollah's war in 2006, with 70 Hezbollah fighters, 13 Lebanese civilians, 7 Israeli troops, and 3 Israeli civilians reported dead so far. Well, the United Nations chief said that Gaza should not become a United Nations protectorate. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said that the Gaza Strip should not become a, quote, UN protectorate, end quote, if Hamas is forced from power after the war. Guterres had said that the United Nations supports a transitional phase involving the United States and the Arab states. Everybody needs to come together to make the conditions for a transition, allowing for a strengthened Palestinian Authority to assume responsibility in Gaza, and then, quote, based on that, to finally move in a determined and irreversible way to a two-state solution. Hamas, which is classified as a terrorist organization by the United States and European Union along with other states, has been in power in Gaza since 2007 after winning the legislative election and ousting the rival Palestinian Authority by force. A two-state solution calls for the establishment of an independent Palestinian state coexisting with Israel. Quote, I think we need a multi-stakeholder approach in which different countries, different entities will cooperate, said Guterres. Quote, for Israel, of course, the United States is the main guarantor of its security. For Palestinians, the neighboring and Arab countries of the region are essential, end quote, he added. Well, the German foreign minister is urging international responsibility in Gaza. In an interview with Deutsche Welle on Monday, German foreign minister Annalena Baerbock called for the international community to play a role in Gaza to protect civilians from the current conflict between Israel and Hamas. Quote, in order to ensure security, we need international responsibility, end quote, Baerbock had said. She also said that Germany is working in partnership with the United States and some Arab countries to ensure that people in Gaza, quote, have safe places where they won't be killed, where they can access clean drinking water and medication, end quote. During a trip to Israel last month, shortly after the conflict broke out, Baerbock said she told the Israeli government, quote, that the people in Gaza must be protected, end quote. Continuing the quote, their fight is with a terrorist organization, Hamas, who wants to destroy Israel and not with civilians in Gaza, innocent people, women and children, innocent Palestinians, she said. Germany, along with Israel, the European Union, the United States, and others, classifies Hamas as a terrorist organization. About nine hours ago, Hamas's leader says that a temporary, quote, truce, end quote, is close. The militant group Hamas has said it was inching closer to a truce, quote, end quote. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh, who lives in Qatar, where Hamas has a political office, said in a statement released on Telegram and carried by news agencies that, quote, we are close to reaching a deal on a truce, end quote. He did not elaborate on details. Negotiators, including Qatari mediators, have been working toward a deal that would secure the release of the more than 200 hostages being held in Gaza since the October 7 attacks. The U.S. government has also said that a potential deal is close. Quote, we believe we're getting closer, end quote, said White House National Security Spokesman John Kirby. Quote, we're still working this hour by hour, Kirby had added. In earlier comments, Kirby said negotiators were prioritizing the release of women, children, and U.S. citizens. U.S. President Joe Biden has also said, quote, a deal is near. Israel has not yet commented on the latest statements by Hamas concerning the potential truce. Hamas is designated as a terrorist organization by several countries, including the United States, Israel, and Germany, as well as the European Union. Okay, bear with me a moment. That's what the issue was. Okay. Well, the president of the International Committee of the Red Cross has met with the leader of the militant group Hamas in Qatar to, quote, advance humanitarian issues. The committee said on Monday, ICRC President Emiliana Spoljaric met Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh, then separately met Qatari authorities acting as mediators in the conflict. The meeting was part of discussions with all parties to the conflict to improve respect for international humanitarian law. The ICRC is not involved in negotiations surrounding the hostages' release, the committee had said. Also about 9 hours ago, it seems that over 10,000 Israeli troops in Gaza, report says, more than 10,000 Israeli soldiers are currently deployed in the Gaza Strip as part of Israel's ground offensive. Israeli newspaper Haaretz cited the
Israeli army is saying Haaretz means the land. Most of the troops are located in the Gaza City neighborhoods of Zeytun and Jabalia, according to Haaretz. It added that several Israeli forces have been killed by friendly fire since the start of the offensive in late October, and the incidents are being investigated to draw out future lessons, the military said. Israel media has put the military death toll since the offensive began at 66 soldiers.
Bear with me a moment. Move on to Africa. Africa, from Africa, calls for reparations grow louder. In Africa, countries impacted by the slave trade and colonial era abuses are raising their voices to demand compensation for historical injustices. It is time for Africa, whose sons and daughters had their freedoms controlled and were sold into slavery, to also receive reparations, said Ghana President Nana Addo Akufo-Addo on a recent reparations conference held in Ghana's capital of Accra. Akufo-Addo's demand for compensation for the millions of African people sold into slavery and for other colonial-era injustices inflicted on the continent are part of a growing worldwide push for compensation. In the latest sign of the movement's increasing momentum, delegates of the Accra Reparation Conference last week agreed to establish a global reparation fund. The African Union, the AU, and the 20-member Caribbean community known as the CARICOM, C-A-R-I-C-O-M, are partnering to form what AU Commission Vice President Monique Nsanzabaganwa called a united front to right historical injustices and ensure the payment of reparations. Speaking at the conference, Nsanzabaganwa stressed that Africa had, quote, borne the brunt of history's injustices and endured the ramifications of a past marked by slavery, colonization, and exploitation, end quote. Continuing, she said, we must acknowledge that these injustices have had a long-term impact, the consequences of which are still felt today. The demand for reparations is not an attempt to rewrite history or to continue the cycle of victimization. It's a call to recognize the undeniable truth and right the wrongs that have gone unpunished for far too long and continue to thrive presently, and Nsanzabaganwa had added. Seemed to 2.5 million kidnapped Africans. Details on how the Global Fund would operate are still fuzzy. At least 12.5 million Africans were kidnapped and forcibly transported by European ships and sold into slavery from the 15th to the 19th century, although some estimates put that number at 20 to 30 million. And those who suffered the brutal voyage ended up toiling under inhumane conditions in the Americas, mostly in Brazil and the Caribbean, ensuring huge profits for their owners. The slave trade was dominated by Britain and Portugal, although the United States, Netherlands, Spain, France, Denmark, and Sweden were also heavily involved. Well, Ghana's crumbling castles are a grim reminder of the slave trade past. This year, Ghana, marking the 400th anniversary of the start of the slave trade, the remains of forts and castles where slaves were held are haunting monuments of the tribulations of captured Africans centuries ago. Anna Hanking Evans, a German Ghanaian lawyer with a focus on international economic laws, said it was, quote, enriching, end quote, to work together with descendants of enslaved Africans from Caribbean and American nations on the quest for reparations. Quote, I think it is so crucial for us to come together and benefit from each other's thought processes, she told Deutsche Welle on the margins of the conference. Quote, while our experiences are very unique, nevertheless, our power lies in togetherness, end quote. Reparation demands are growing across Africa. Earlier this month, South African politician Julius Malema joined the debate after King Charles III's visit to Kenya in October. Quote, the British have got no business
putting their foot here in Kenya, except they should pay reparations to Kenyans, he said. In Kenya, King Charles spoke of, quote, abhorrent and unjustifiable acts of violence, end quote, under British rule without saying the word sorry, quote, end quote. But on social media, Kenyans were less interested in an apology than in tangible reparations. The month before, the Dutch king and queen were confronted by an angry group of indigenous Khoi and San people protesting their visit to South Africa. As the royal couple toured Cape Town's Slave Lodge, which once held slaves belonging to the Dutch East India Company, a group of Khoi and San leaders shouted slogans about Dutch colonizers stealing land from their ancestors. They held up signs saying, quote, we want compensation, end quote. Dutch colonizers in South Africa took away Khoi and San land and indigenous South Africans into servitude. Well, trillions are owed in compensations. Many studies have attempted to estimate the cost of the slave trade in Africa. The recent report on reparations for transatlantic chattel slavery in the Americas and the Caribbean concluded that under international law, slaving nations owe staggering sums. The analysis known as the Battle Report estimates that the global cost of the slave trade could be as high as $131 trillion, both for harm perpetrated during the slave era and damages caused post-enslavement. According to the report, the United States of America owes nearly $27 trillion, Great Britain $24 trillion, and Portugal $21 trillion in reparations. The United Nations recently released a report outlining concrete steps to address the harm suffered by people of African descent. The document acknowledges that the assessment of the economic damages can, quote, be extremely difficult owing to the length of time past and the difficulty of identifying the perpetrators and victims, end quote. However, it emphasized that, quote, such difficulties cannot be the basis for nullifying the existence of underlying legal obligations, end quote. In an illustration of how politically fraught compensation payments can be, in 2021, Germany recognized the genocide of Herero and Nama people during German colonial rule in what is now Namibia and pledged to pay $1.9 billion to the Namibian government. The funds are to be spent over 30 years in regions populated by descendants of victims of the Herero and Nama genocide. Germany also was strongly criticized for failing to negotiate directly with Herero and Nama community groups. The declaration, jointly by the Namibian government, also didn't include the words, quote, reparations, end quote, or compensation, end quote. Germany continues to assert that there is no legal basis for individual or collective reparation claims by individual descendants of victim groups such as the Herero and Nama or their associations against the German government. Rights organizations, including the Berlin-based European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, as well as Human Rights Watch, disagree. Quote, they say that that Germany does have legal obligations under human rights laws, such as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. For the AU's Monique Nsanzabaganwa, reparations are more than financial transactions. Quote, they are a moral and ethical obligation. They represent our acknowledgement of past wrongs, and more importantly, the resolve to make amends. There is also looted art, restitution in the crosshairs of world politics. Colonial looted art is finally being returned to its countries of origin, but new problems lie ahead. As former colonies now fear the return of looted art may take the place of a comprehensive reparation for colonial crimes. The documentary shows how the return of looted art leads to new disputes. One example is Nigeria. In a move that would have had been considered unthinkable just a few years ago. Germany is returning a large part of the disputed Benin bronzes to Nigeria. For years, legal arguments had been made as to why the bronzes were, quote, rightfully, end quote, in Germany despite colonial crimes. Now, however, a heightened awareness of post-colonialism, moral obligations is increasingly determining action. The descendants of Nigerian slaves have criticized the terms of the return of the Benin bronzes. These cultural goods are being returned to Benin City, a center of the criminal slave trade. So is restitution being made to former perpetrators? Were too few descendants of those affected included in the restitution considerations? To whom exactly should the looted cultural treasure be returned? To nation states whose arbitrary borders are often themselves the result of colonialism, or to the descendants of traditional cultures of origin within these states who were once the victims of colonial encroachment? Debates about this have only just begun. What are the arguments in favor of art historian Benedict Savoy's, quote, give it all back, end quote, demands? And is there merit to the warnings of ethnologist Brigitte Hauser-Schäublin, who says, quote, you are gambling away world heritage, end quote. Position on looted art also affects Europe. Poland and Germany, for example, are fighting over the precious manuscripts of the Berlinka, quote-unquote, collection in Krakow. The indigenous Sami people in the far north of Scandinavia also have justified claims for restitution, and not just to Berlin. A Dutch farmer saves Germany's last socialist pigs. This is interesting. A Dutch farmer has rescued pedigree pigs from the former East Germany from the brink of extinction. As the Lycoma pigs are not suited to modern factory farms, the farmer is likely the only person breeding these animals today. Bear with me a moment. Let's look at something else in Asia. Myanmar's rebel offensive. How worried should India be? A Myanmar rebel offensive that analysts say poses a threat to the military junta's grip on power has led to growing concerns about a spillover of tensions into border areas in India's northeast. India has been cautiously eyeing an expanding rebel offensive by, quote, the Three Brotherhood Alliance, 3BHA, in neighboring Myanmar. New Delhi's concerns about security are growing, particularly in the states of Manipur and Mizoram that border northern Myanmar. The 3BHA, comprised of the Myanmar National Democratic Alliance Army, the MNDAA, the Ta'ang National Liberation Army, the TNLA, and the Arakan Army, the AA, launched the offensive in Myanmar's northern Shan state on October 27th. The widening attack, named Operation 1027, after its start date, has reportedly overrun more than 135 positions, according to media reports. I see a call has come in. They somehow left. So maybe they'll call again. We'll find out in a moment. Refugees are fleeing after the latest fighting. Myanmar's military, the Tatmadaw, is believed to have lost control of its main border crossings with China, as well as Rikgaldar, a town bordering the Indian state of Mizoram. Armed groups have also taken the fight to Kaya state bordering Thailand and the Sagaing region and Chin state that border India. The fighting led to thousands of Myanmar nationals, including dozens of soldiers, seeking shelter in Mizoram last week. The troops were subsequently flown to another border crossing and sent back to Myanmar. India has called for an end to the violence. Quote, we reiterate our call for the return of peace, stability, and democracy in Myanmar, end quote, India Foreign Ministry spokesperson Arindam Bakshi told reporters, quote, as a result of the fighting in Rika Dar area in Chin State, opposite Zohar Tar in Mizoram on the India-Myanmar border, there have been movement of Myanmar nationals to the Indian side. We are deeply concerned with such incidents close to our border, Bakshi had said. Experts and academics who have been closely monitoring the situation believe any further escalation in hostilities could be problematic, given that Mizoram shares a 317-mile-long porous border with Myanmar. Unbelievable. Avinash Paliwal, who teaches at SOAS University in London, said that Indian authorities have adopted a dual defensive approach of continuing to support the junta to avoid dislocation of their broader interest in Myanmar while beefing up cross-border checks. Quote, the situation in Manipur has direct links to Myanmar, and it is unlikely that New Delhi will undertake strategic revisions in its approach towards its eastern neighbor in the near term. Paliwal, who specializes in South Asian strategy, strategic affairs, advised Deutsche Welle. Quote, if the pushback against the NAIPDY succeeds in toppling the junta, which is not a given at this point in time, it will require India to build equities within the resistance ranks on terms set by the latter, added Paliwal. India's Deputy National Security Advisor, Vikram Misri, attended an October 15 event in Myanmar, marking the 8th anniversary of a rebel ceasefire. He urged that the treaty be reinforced to resolve ethnic conflicts. So can India maintain ties with Myanmar? Critics of the 2015 Nationwide Ceasefire Agreement, the NCA, say it is in tatters since the 2021 coup, which unleashed a bloody crackdown on dissent and sparked renewed fighting with some of its signatories. But New Delhi has maintained a cooperative relationship with the Myanmar military, which calls itself the State Administration Council, the SAC, since the conflict began in 2021. Indian government-owned companies and private firms supplied $51 million worth of arms, dual-use items, and raw materials to the military junta since February of 2021, according to a United Nations report released in May. Quote, we have engagement and cooperation with them, a neighboring country, on various issues. Whatever actions we take are in the light of our interest, said Bakshi in response to a query on India's arms exports to Myanmar's junta. Santa Mariette de Souza, founder and president of Mantaya, an independent research forum, said there are no indications that India's foreign ministry is revisiting its policy of standing behind the Myanmar junta. Quote, its actions, including engulfing the junta, supporting it in the past with weapons and training for its officials, and periodically sending high officials to functions organized by the junta, point to the opposite, D'Souza advised Deutsche Welle. Quote, this has happened despite several requests by the parallel National Unity Government to New Delhi to change its pro-junta stance, end quote. She pointed out that under a rather ambivalent wait-and-watch policy, New Delhi continues to hope that the ongoing rebel onslaught is a temporary phenomenon and that the junta will eventually prevail, end quote. Further, New Delhi is certainly concerned about the spillover of the conflict into the northeastern states, but seems to be pinning its hope on the junta and not the rebels to minimize this, added D'Souza. Bear with me a moment. Oh, one second here. Let's look at what's happening in Germany. Germany's budget woes, it's a threat to the government? That's the question. Finance Minister Christian Lindner
has imposed a freeze on the federal budget. This is the latest dramatic twist triggered by a bombshell ruling by the Federal Constitutional Court, which threatens all policy plans. A matter-of-fact announcement was issued by the Finance Ministry on Monday evening. With immediate effect, a spending freeze applies to almost the entire budget for 2023, it read. This drastic step was taken due to the need to review the overall budgetary situation for the federal budget, read a statement from the ministry. The government is sending the message that it considers last week's dramatic landmark ruling by Germany's highest judges to have much more severe consequences than initially thought. The Constitutional Court's verdict on November 15 was a political bombshell for Chancellor Olaf Scholz and his federal government. It ruled that the government cannot reallocate 60 billion euros meant to fight the COVID-19 pandemic to instead address climate change. More money in the form of credit was earmarked for the pandemic than turned out to be necessary. Shortly after coming to power in late 2021, the current government, led by the center-left Social Democrats, the SPD, in coalition with the Greens and neoliberal Free Democrats, the FDP, transferred the remaining allowance to a climate transformation fund. The fund was to be used to finance energy-efficient refurbishment of buildings and electromobility projects, but also for the modernization of Germany's rail network. The court ruled this fund to be unconstitutional, saying that loans cannot be taken out for one purpose and then be reapportioned for another, and also that emergency funds cannot be set up by 1 year and then used to cover projects spanning several years. Germany's debt brake, quote-unquote, enshrined in the Constitution in 2009 in the aftermath of the European financial crisis to ensure the nation's debt to gross domestic product would not exceed limits imposed by the European Union. It restricts new debt to 0.35% of nominal gross domestic product annually for the federal government. It also bans it for Germany's regional states. The debt rules were suspended to fight the COVID pandemic, as it was classified as an emergency exception. Well, climate change, which some have called a crisis, has not been officially designated as such, and therefore the normal debt rules still apply. The government, the court said, therefore can't borrow the money. The latest ruling was in response to a lawsuit filed by the conservative opposition bloc of Christian Democrats and Christian Social Union, the CDU and the CSU. After the verdict, its lawmakers have been jubilant. The conservatives were in power until 2 years ago and are again polling ahead of their competitors. So what options does the government have now? And first and foremost, can the ruling coalition survive this crisis? The High Court's ruling lays bare the tensions inherent among the coalition partners. Well, the SPD wants to financially protect low and middle income voters, who it believes have shouldered enough of a burden. Given the multitude of crises and projects facing Germany, voices within the SPD have been calling for higher taxes for some time already. In his reaction to the ruling party leaders, Lars Klingbeil stopped short of explicitly demanding tax hikes, but he hinted at turbulent negotiations. And we do not now stop modernizing this country. In the coalition, we're going to put our heads together with the government, the parliamentary groups, and with the parties. We'll have to discuss a lot of fundamentals, he said. On Tuesday, the 11th, November 21, rather, the leader of the Social Democrats parliamentary group, Rolf Mützenich, spoke out, quote, "Some things that are currently happening in the world are leading to extraordinary emergency situations that are beyond the control of the state and are significantly affecting the state's financial situation," he said. He called on all three government partners, to quickly state an emergency situation for 2024 in the Bundestag, which allows it to take out a special loan and set up a new emergency fund with the votes of the ruling coalition. Parliament has this week intending to vote on the budget for the coming year 2024, but it remains to be seen whether this will happen. Well, tax hikes, however, are a no-go for the FDP, the party of Finance Minister Christian Lindner. An end to the debt brake is likewise off the table. The FDP has maintained its budget-cutting ways and considers the Greens' investment plans exaggerated. They have now suggested cutting back on social spending. As Lindner has repeatedly said, the FDP rejects any tinkering with the debt brake, and in any case, changing the mechanism would require a two-thirds majority in Parliament, and with the opposition, CDU, CSU, firmly backing the debt brake, that would be currently impossible. Well, the Green Party co-leader Ricardo Lang has rejected the idea of saving on social issues. Quote, we know that right-wing parties in particular are constantly mobilizing people's social concerns and fears, he told public broadcaster ZDF. With the debt brake staying in place and tax hikes likely doomed to fail against the resistance of the FDP and opposition CDU, CSU, the only option remaining is tight-fisted austerity, and that would hit the Greens hardest, for whom investment in climate change mitigation have become an existential necessity. The Greens, the only party in government that has not seen its voter support diminished since the 2021 general election, see the expensive, climate-friendly retooling of the state as the core reason for their participation in government. They are willing to take on new debt to finance their plans. The Greens have already swallowed several bitter pills in the coalition, notably the recent tightening of refugee policies. If the Greens' core issue, climate change mitigation, loses financial backing, the party could soon be asking what point there is in staying in the coalition. Later this week, at the Green Party Congress in Karlsruhe, Robert Habeck, the German Vice Minister, Economy Minister, will surely be getting an earful from the rank and file in the party, in his party. Influential environmental groups are also putting on the pressure. Greenpeace has called the Constitutional Court's ruling a, quote, bitter setback for climate protection. Well, is the government without direction? Evidently, Germany's three-way coalition government is not marching in one direction. Chancellor Scholz attempted to put on a brave face, telling the parliament that he remained, quote, convinced that the governing coalition will succeed in making all the right suggestions, end quote. But the government approval rating among voters has hit rock bottom. Fresh elections would therefore likely hurt all three parties. The SPD, Greens, and FDP, are desperately seeking a solution, one that's nowhere in sight. And this is a good question. Who pays for climate damage and where does the money go? An array of climate funds promised to help poorer countries either stop climate change or adapt to its consequences. But what do they actually cover and why is it all so contentious? Fossil fuels powered the Industrial Revolution and the economic success of many countries. But burning oil, gas, and coal produces greenhouse gases that warm the atmosphere and warp the climate. Advanced industrial nations have historically contributed most of the human-induced climate crisis because they burned fossil fuels for so long to grow their economies. And many analysts, activists, and heads of state in low-income countries argue big
historical emitters like the United States and Europe should largely foot the bill for climate change. But what does that mean exactly? So what is climate finance? One of the ideas behind climate financing is to support developing countries in steering the economies clear of climate wrecking fossil fuels. Another is that wealthy nations should help poorer ones hit hardest by global heating to adapt to the changing climate. And these ideas have been central to global climate negotiations in some form or another since the 1992 World Climate Summit in Rio de Janeiro. But climate financing is perhaps most commonly associated with a pledge made by industrialized countries at the 2009 Copenhagen United Nations Climate Summit to raise $100 billion a year by 2020, whereas in 2015 in Paris, delegates agreed to keep paying this amount annually until 2025 and then set a new figure. So how does climate financing implemented? To implement the $100 billion pledge, industrialized countries are primarily committing public funds. But surprisingly, they want to raise cash through private investment. Public funds from donor countries account for the largest share of climate financing. About half of this flows bilaterally from donor to to recipient states, and largely in the form of development aid. The other portion is multilateral money, meaning the multiple states give money to multiple other states. And this money either comes from climate programs run via multilateral banks, like the World Bank and the African and Asian Development Banks, or the money is allocated through multinational climate funds. Well, there's the Green Climate Fund. The most prominent of the multilateral money pots is the Green Climate Fund, GCF. Its resources are intended both for measures to slow climate change, such as the expansion of renewable energy, and for adapting to extreme weather and other impacts of planetary heating. To date, donor countries have pledged about $20 billion. So far, $12.8 billion of it has been approved for projects, and $3.6 billion has already been spent on specific programs. Most of the projects are in Africa and Asia, but there are also some in Latin America, the Caribbean, and Eastern Europe. Every 4 years, donor countries are expected to replenish the fund. Just under half of the money is given in the form of favorable loans, and the second half as direct grants that recipient states do not have to repay. Another fund that receives money from the $100 billion pledge is the Adaption Fund. It's a relatively small pot of money with no fixed replenishment cycles. Donor countries pay whatever they can or wish to. Its goal to support projects that help countries adapt to the consequences of the climate crisis, and these could be measures against flooding, for example, or posting heat-resistant crops. Developing countries receive the money as a subsidy rather than a loan. This is advantageous as action on adaption doesn't usually generate any profit until climate protection measures such as building wind turbines or solar panels which generate electricity can be sold. Well, the Least Developed Countries Fund covers the world's 46 poorest nations, operating solely on grants which do not have to be paid or repaid. It is intended to finance emergency
Okay, we're going to end the session. Take care and goodbye.